Welcome to the ToRead.net podcast. This is your host, Terry Yule, and I'm pleased that you have joined us. These podcasts feature interviews, sound clips, and other items of interest for members of the Double Read community. Now, let's enjoy the musicians, the music, and the wonderful art of Double Reads. Well, welcome. I'm here with Billy Short, and he has just completed a fantastic session at IDRS in Granada, Spain, and the title was Bassoon Excerpts from the Opera Repertoire. So I was glad I could get a hold of you, Billy. How did the session go?
I think it went fine. I hope that some of my murmurings contained something of use for the people in attendance.
I thought it was really fantastic, the way you worked with the students there and the insights you had into it. And I hope in the future you can be sharing more of those insights with us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
What are your current duties? I know you're playing opera a lot. Do you teach as well? Just describe that.
Yeah, I'm just finished my sixth season as principal bassoon of the Metropolitan Opera. So they say the first 7 years are the hardest. So I'm hoping that after next year I'll feel deeply confident in my understanding of how to play, 130 performances of opera a year.
Wow.
But in addition to that, I serve on the faculties at Temple University, Manhattan School of Music, and the Juilliard School.
How does that work out? I mean, are there certain days where you have days off and you can get on a train and travel?
The thing about the Met schedule is that it's enormously busy but enormously flexible. Which is very different from your typical symphony schedule, where if you're working that week, you are playing, Thursday night, Friday afternoon, Saturday night, maybe Sunday afternoon. For us, because there are seven performances at the Met per week and two principals, we have much more flexibility. And so that allows me to fit in various things. I usually go to Philadelphia to teach at Temple on Sundays. So it's a very full schedule, but it's manageable, and I'm very lucky that I get to do it.
You must be full of energy to be able to do all of that.
I do my best. I do fall asleep occasionally on the train ride home from Philadelphia, though.
Double read jobs in our profession are really quite scarce, and the competition just seems to be heating up. Do you have some advice to giving to the young student who is seeking this as a profession?
Yeah, there are two things that I would say, and first of all, you're absolutely right. Jobs, in the traditional orchestral sense, are not becoming more numerous. And there are an ever-increasing number of players entering the profession. So I think it's essential for anyone considering embarking on this career, this life, to go into it with their eyes open. That being said, it seems to me that right now there are more ways to make a living in music than there have ever been before. I mean, you've got your standard orchestral route, you've got your teaching route on numerous levels and in numerous ways. You've also got so many people who are freelancers who run their own nonprofits, their own concert series. This myth that classical music is somehow dying is something that I'm on a sort of perpetual crusade against, because classical music has never been more prevalent or more accessible than it is now, and I think that presents a lot of opportunities for young people. For those who are looking for the traditional career path, I want an orchestra job, I would say that no matter how many people there are, showing up to an audition or graduating from music schools, my experience has been there's always room at the top for quality.
Mm-hmm.
Because, those people who truly put in the work.
Right.
Who, just dedicate themselves, who are obsessive about doing the work, about the process of improving, tend to do just fine for themselves.
Sure.
Can I guarantee that you'll be the principal bassoonist of the New York Philharmonic? No one can promise that. But if you really, really put in the work, then in my experience, things seem to work out just fine.
Wonderful. So what instrument are you playing on now?
I play on a 15,000 series Heckel that I actually bought from one of my teachers, from Ben Kamens, when I was studying with him in grad school. And you know, I spent some time experimenting with it, and I sort of loved how much it made my life easier than what I was used to, playing on an older Heckel that did not have as even a scale as I would have liked, and you know, had a sound prone to spreading, and this just helped me a lot with that, so I've been very happy with it.
One question, fingering-wise, the F-sharp 3 above open F, mm-hmm. Do you tend to use the little finger F-sharp all the time, or do you use the thumb?
I use the little finger whenever humanly possible.
Okay.
I mean, if I'm playing a piece that has rapid B major scales, it's distinctly possible I'll throw in a thumb. But my experience has just been that using the pinky keeps the pitch down, keeps the sound a little bit more covered, and
sure.
I like it for that reason.
Sure. In that Marriage of Figaro excerpt we mm-hmm. heard in the master class, then did you use the thumb? That's one you used the thumb.
For that I use the thumb only because I've played it for so long using the thumb since before I even knew that there was a difference, you know, qualitatively between the two F sharp fingerings, that it's too late to switch back now.
Okay. Would you recommend to your student they use the little finger then, if they're starting out on that excerpt?
Most of my students are not starting out on Figaro for the first time
when they
come to me. So at that point, I mean, my experience has been that it's possible to play it acceptably in tune.
Yeah.
You know, using the thumb F sharp. Because, you know, if you're going, you know, if that F-sharp isn't exactly 14 cents flat, exactly where a major third should be, it goes by quickly enough that you're not likely to notice. So there was a great quote from a great conductor once that, you know, the intonation doesn't have to be perfect, but it can't be sour. You know, if someone comes in and is heinously sharp on that F-sharp, then absolutely we're going to talk about...
Sure.
ways to correct that, which may include using a different fingering, but to me it's more about not letting it catch your ear.
Sure. So what cane do you use, and do you make your own reeds, and have any advice about all of that?
I asked Bernie Garfield when I was studying with him in my undergrad what cane I should buy, and his answer has always stuck with me. He said, buy it all sucks. So what I do is every couple of years I buy, you know, a pound or two of tube cane from every supplier I can get my hands on. Then I just mix it all together and I forget what's what.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, interesting.
Because my feeling is by the time I've gone through the whole processing process, clipped all these reeds, come to a conclusion about the quality of a given batch of reeds, by that point, the next batch I order from the same supplier could be completely different in terms of quality. So for me, I'd actually rather remove whatever inherent biases I have
sure.
towards some cane sources versus others.
But it's interesting to me that you don't track within a batch, because it may be, you find that the diversity of the batch is so wide that it's not useful to track within that and say, oh, well, this is no good quality, I'm going to just throw it all out.
The diversity within the batch is certainly a factor, but what I've found in, there have been years, I sort of identify one project per year,
sure.
read-wise, to experiment with a given quality. So, for example, my very first one was experimenting with a hardness tester.
Okay.
And so for that, I did track the cane sources. I had, I think, seven or eight different sources, among other variables, just so that I could isolate what was actually causing success or failure. And what was shocking to me about that was that among those cane sources, they all sort of tended for me towards one out of six was a good piece of cane.
Oh.
The sources that I thought, oh, this is a good batch of cane, one out of six. The sources that I thought, oh, this is a crap batch, one out of six.
Huh.
And so based on that experience, I decided it was best to get rid of that mental bias on my part entirely.
Okay. Did the hardness tester help you at all?
Yes.
It did. Okay.
Yeah, I found,
so you find it in a certain range...
For me, it's past a certain point of softness. I had a 0% success rate.
Okay.
Yeah. Up until then, it was sort of statistical noise.
Okay.
You know, there was no neat bell curve or anything
sure.
where somewhere in the middle is the ideal hardness. It was just I had some success up until this number, at which point I had zero success out of something like 80 something reads that were that number or softer. I think so. Thank you so much for the opportunity to chat.
Thanks so much, Billy. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.